Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On March 3rd, 2011, climate activist Tim DeChristopher was convicted to 2 years in federal prison in Utah. He was convicted on one count of false representation and another on violating the Federal Onshore Oil and Gas Leasing Reform Act. The crime? Well, on December 19th, 2008, he bid nearly $2 million on 22,000 acres of land at an oil and gas auction in Utah. The federal government went after Tim DeChristopher because he, quote, made false statements during the bidding process and had no intention to pay for the land or drill on it. He merely wanted to make a statement and save the land. The documentary Bitter 70 tells his story. Here's Tim DeChristopher in the film describing what he did at a press conference.
During his arrest, Thoreau lectured regularly on civil disobedience. His arrest was significant in that Thoreau made a distinction between living up to one's own principles and educating.
Sorry there, we played the wrong clip. We'll bring that back to you in just a minute. That is a clip from Bitter 70, a documentary that tells Tim DeChristopher's story and why he decided to make the bids knowing he might end up in jail. Tim will be released from federal prison on April 21st, one day before Earth Day. He will have served 18 months behind bars. And on Earth Day, Bitter 70 will be screened in Salt Lake City, and Tim will be in the audience to see the film for the first time. Bitter 70 will be screened at this year's University of San Francisco Human Rights Film Festival on Thursday, April 4th. At 7:30, there will be a post-screening Q&A with Dylan Rose Schneider, Tim's power of attorney, and Matt Leonard, U.S. Actions Team Coordinator with the environmental group 350.org. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about Bitter 70 and what happens when citizens challenge the U.S. government's power structure. And we're joined by the film's directors, Beth and George Gage. They've been creating award-winning environmental and social justice documentaries since 1990. Their mission is to create compelling personal films that empower viewers, initiate dialogue, and prompt action on provocative issues. And Beth and George join us on the phone from Colorado. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Hi, it's great to have you. So we're going to actually, we're going to get that clip about from Tim telling his own story. But before we do, when did you first hear about Tim's story?
Well, we first heard about Tim's story very briefly after he took his action, the very beginning of 2009, and we read about it in our local Telluride, Colorado newspaper, and then through a series of coincidences, we got to meet Tim within a week because we were at a film festival that he had also been invited to, and we had an earlier film that we had done, and it was an environmental film festival, and Tim had been invited there to speak. And so I knew all about him, and so did George. And so we, the very first night that we got to the film festival, we made sure that we met him. And we arranged over the weekend to follow him around for the next period of time, however long it would take for his story to unfold. And at the time, obviously, we thought it was going to be much shorter, but here we are now, I think, almost four and a half years later. So
it's amazing. I mean, and the other thing is, in the film, you keep stating that the trial was postponed. And during the course of the auction and then the trial, he was touring the country. He was speaking to college students, climate activists. I mean, he really used his voice during this time.
Yeah, he did. And it was great for us. It was great for the film, and it was great for the message. And that's the kind of guy Tim is. I mean, Tim is not the kind of person that's going to sit around and brood or go to the local bar or whatever. He is a real activist. And in a lot of ways, I look at this film as the birth or the progress of an activist, because he just got more and more active. And, of course, mountaintop removal was really on the top of his list, because Tim grew up in West Virginia and was absolutely sickened seeing what's happened there since he's left. And also Larry Gibson, who's in the film and unfortunately has passed away, has been a hero of Tim's because of his fight against the mining companies in West Virginia, right around the hometown where Tim grew up.
Well, before we play a clip of Tim talking about what happened, why don't you both talk a little bit about Tim? Who is Tim DeChristopher?
Well, I'll do the first part. He started out as a football player. He played football in high school in West Virginia. He's a very good athlete. He's a very sensitive person. He's a very smart person. He's really educated himself well. And he really cares, and he really cares about not only saving this planet for his generation, but for generations to come. And I was just telling someone on the phone that whenever he gives a speech or whenever he talks, it's always coming directly from the heart. It's not written text or text on a teleprompter. It's from the heart. And I think he's a real visionary. He's a visionary in terms of trying to put a hold on climate change.
And I would say also he thinks very deeply, and he likes to have fun with his friends and all of that. But you know, he really is in many ways a pretty serious guy, and he thinks very deeply on subjects, and he's very sort of single-minded when he's concerned with an issue. And he took it really, really seriously when he began to believe that climate change was upon us, and there was, very little that we could do to stop it. And it took him a couple of years to think about, to stop being depressed, and to think about the fact that even if something is almost a fait accompli, that you still need to work to do all that you can and have hope, and also bring a sense of community to the people around you that you care about. So I think that, he's a serious person, and he's very thoughtful and very caring about society and about what we aim to lose if we don't really wake up immediately.
The only reason I mention football players, you'll see him bulk up in the movie getting ready for prison, and he can really bulk up.
Well, we're going to hear a clip from the film Bitter 70. And again, on December 19th, 2008, Tim DeChristopher finished a final exam at the University of Utah. He took a bus to downtown Salt Lake City to protest the sale of oil and gas leases on federal lands in Utah. I'm sure a lot of you have seen the gorgeous red rocks. Those were also part of the plan. And instead, he decided to go inside and start bidding. And here is Tim DeChristopher in the film speaking to a press conference.
I'm Tim DeChristopher. I'm a 27-year-old economics student at the University of Utah. And earlier today, I was indicted on a couple of charges by the U.S. Attorney's Office. On December 19th, 2008, I took what I considered to be an ethical, necessary, and direct action to protect our planet, our democracy, and my fellow human beings. My action stopped what I believe was an illegal and certainly unethical auction. My motivations to act against this auction came from the exploitation of public lands, the lack of a transparent and participatory government, and the imminent danger of climate change.
And that is a clip from the documentary Bitter 70, and it tells Tim DeChristopher's story. He bid nearly $2 million on 22,000 acres of land at that auction, and the federal government went after him because he, quote, made false statements during the bidding process, had no intention to pay for the land or drill on it. You know, it's so interesting because we don't really hear much about these leases. And it was fascinating to see the footage of mostly, I think they were almost all men in the room, all ages, bidding on this land. Beth, can you talk a little bit about how these auctions actually work?
Well, the Bureau of Land Management apparently has these, I believe it's quarterly. I think the auctions are quarterly. I'm not positive. And if you are an energy company, a company or even an individual that is interested in drilling for oil or gas, you are in touch with the Bureau of Land Management, and they notify you every time they're going to have an auction and what lands are going to be auctioned off. And the interesting thing was, because I found this out by going to Tim's trial and when they were discussing how this happens, is that it's happening every quarter, and it's an ongoing situation. And as you said, we don't really know about it. I never knew that they went on. I think people probably don't know about them unless the land is something that that an individual either lives on or lives near, and all of a sudden finds out that, hey, there may be oil wells drilled next to your property or even on your property if you don't own the mineral rights, which most of us don't in the West. And so this particular auction was very much protested because it was land that surrounded our national parks in Utah and some national monuments, and environmental groups plus people who live in the Moab, Utah area said, wait a minute, you know, this is beautiful land that people come to see, that recreate on it, that is part of our sort of national heritage, and all of a sudden we're going to have oil and gas drilling and, you know, all the trucks and roads and things like that that engenders. So a lot of people were aware of it. And normally, you know, as you were asking, normally this doesn't happen. There aren't any people protesting because we don't even know it's happening. But, you know, if you take a drive along some of the roads in the West, and apparently now in Pennsylvania, in the Midwest, in the Northeast, I know California, you know, is, you know, dealing with this currently, there are especially natural gas and fracking wells going up everywhere.
Mm.
And I think we really need to be much more aware of what's going on and look into what's going on in the Bureau of Land Management, the Department of Interior. You can go on their website and you know, kind of see what's happening. But it's millions of acres all over the country that are being exploited for this.
The wells that you see from the highway are just a tip of the iceberg. In other words, we've talked to some private pilots that say that when you're flying over the lands inward, away from the highways, that's when you see the fracking tanks every 100 yards or so. There's another one.
And what did you both learn about how the BLM works? And talk a little bit about what you learned about the Bush administration, because you do have a few former people who worked with the BLM, specifically Dennis Willis, a BLM manager in Utah, worked for the agency for 30 years. He said, quote, "I have been in meetings with oil and gas companies that have come in and said, we own the White House. You will do it our way." So what did you learn about the BLM, George?
Well, it goes back actually to our previous film called American Outrage, and we learned that the BLM, in our opinion, was playing ball with some of the mining companies to do deep pit mining in northern Nevada and some of it even on sacred land of the Shoshone Native Americans. And we learned that the BLM was basically going along with it and allowing the mining companies to mine in these very sacred areas and just absolutely destroy Mother Earth. I mean, these deep pit mines mining for gold are hundreds and hundreds of feet deep. I mean, they're like 7 or 8 stories down into the earth, and some of them take up over a mile of surface area. So we started to learn then, and we also learned that they wouldn't talk to us. We learned that the hard way, trying to get different interviews with different people from the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of Interior. And then when we were working on Bitter 70, we actually even had meetings canceled where we would be driving 5 or 6 hours to an interview, and suddenly the person that we're being interviewed, in one particular case, the head of the BLM in Utah, gets a phone call from Washington, D.C., saying, there's really no upside for you to take this interview. There's no upside for the BLM. So we learned it was very, very hard to get their point of view, even though I probably wouldn't agree with their point of view, it was impossible to get it. And I also learned that they, in my opinion, are very, very tight with big industry and big business, as so much of our government unfortunately is.
And what ultimately happened to the land that was auctioned that day on December 19th, 2008?
Well, you know, what's very interesting, and it's taken a long time for this to happen, in February of this year, 2013, the Tenth Circuit Court in Denver, I believe, took those parcels, the 77 parcels that were the most contentious parcels of that auction, and it's something like 150,000 acres, were taken off the auction block permanently. And the way I understand it, if Tim had not interrupted that auction, what he did stopped the auction. They stopped the auction, they talked to him, and then they, you know, told the people who had been bidding that we will look into this, and then we'll have the auction again later. Well, that was so late in the Bush administration that there really wasn't time to reschedule it before the Obama administration came in. And since no actual transactions took place that day, that land wasn't considered auctioned off, and so it could be saved. And if it had actually been paid for, if the transactions had gone through, then the land that was purchased would have been a lease for 10 years. So, it certainly was a difficult situation for Tim, but I believe his actions saved 150,000 acres surrounding national parks.
Wow. And, I mean, you're talking about the gorgeous Red Rock area of Utah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is.
As Robert Redford says, is arguably some of the most beautiful land in the United States.
Wow. So you can really, it is safe to say that he actually did, because of what he did, bidding on this land, $2 million, 22,000 acres, that action actually saved that land.
Well, it actually saved that land and another 130,000 acres because they actually removed 77 parcels. He won, I think, 14 parcels, or bid on and won. But those parcels plus, another whatever 50 or so parcels, 60 parcels, were removed. So, it was a very effective act of peaceful civil disobedience.
Just imagine standing there and looking at a sunset through one of those great big natural arches and seeing an oil well or a fracking complex through the arch. I mean, it would be outrageous.
Yeah, it's amazing, and the footage you have is just gorgeous in the film. We're speaking today with Beth and George Gage. They are directors of the film Bitter 70, which tells the story of climate activist Tim DeChristopher. He was convicted to 2 years in federal prison for bidding on 22,000 acres of land for $2 million. The federal government went after him for making, quote, false statements during the bidding process. He will be released from federal prison on April 21st, one day before Earth Day. And this film will be shown this Thursday, April 4th at 7:30 at the University of San Francisco's Human Rights Film Festival, 3 days of amazing films. And you can find information on our website, yourcallradio.org. And we'd also love to hear from you. It's interesting because what does this tell you about what happens when citizens take on the U.S. government and really stand up to corporate and government power? I mean, you've got a young guy who took part in a nonviolent action, very nonviolent, and was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison. So what does this say about what happens when we stand up to power in the United States? And have you heard about Tim DeChristopher? Because when he was convicted, it got a lot of attention. But over the past couple of years, it's been pretty quiet for the most part. So what questions do you have about his case and how oil and gas land is actually leased in this country? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Beth, after spending so much time following Tim and really looking at the larger issues here, what does this really tell you about what happens when U.S. citizens take a stand like this?
Well, the interesting thing was that shortly after the auction and Tim's action, the new Secretary of Interior, Salazar, invalidated the auction for the first time, said, we have to look into this. And so he said that they weren't going to put that land back on the auction block. And so when they did that, I thought, well, they're not going to do anything to Tim because, they're saying that we have to look into this auction because it wasn't presented correctly. It wasn't perhaps a valid auction. The land perhaps should not have been auctioned off. So why would they do anything to this young man who stopped the auction? And then a couple of months later, during the Obama administration, Tim was indicted. And the indictment, the two federal felony charges, had penalties of up to 10 years in prison and $750,000 in fines. So I thought, my gosh, what, here's a college student that took an action that, as you said, didn't hurt anyone, didn't damage any property, and they could put him in prison for 10 years. It really showed me that the government and corporate America does not want any challenge to its power. And it also showed me that corporate America has a lot of influence on our government, because the way that Tim's lawyer found out that Tim was going to be indicted was a reporter found out that information from an energy executive. So before the lawyers knew, the energy companies knew that Tim was going to be indicted by the federal government. So that really said something about, you know, who's talking to whom.
And what would you add to that, George? What has this really taught you about how this process works?
Well, one positive thing, if I could mention, is that Tim was put in solitary, or what they call the SHU, for a while. And the activists, when they found out about it and just called and sent so many emails and everything else to the prison, that within 24 hours, although Tim had been in for 3 weeks, immediately released him from there, and not only released him from there, but sent him to a prison that he originally asked to go to, which was one in Colorado, so he could be near his parents. So it shows me that, I know this is a little bit off-center from what you asked, but it shows me that when people really stand up as people and say, we won't take this anymore, this is wrong, sometimes we can get a good result, just like Tim got a good result in that auction.
And also in the film, one of his lawyers said that a lot of pressure was coming from the oil and gas companies to have him prosecuted. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, we wish we knew more about it. I mean, the lawyers tried to find out exactly how the oil and gas industry knew before they did that Tim was going to be indicted. They tried to find out exactly how this process of putting Tim in solitary happened. But I think that a lot of dead ends, a lot of information is really held away from us. So it's very difficult to get this information.
And also, as a federal inmate, he was, again, sent to federal prison. But last October, he was transferred to a halfway house in Salt Lake City. Is that right? And he is not allowed to talk to the media. What other restrictions are on Tim? Were you able to visit him in prison?
We were able to visit him, not in the first prison, Hurlong, because they quote, deemed us media. So we were not allowed to visit him there. But once, after the solitary happened and he was transferred to Englewood, Colorado, we were able to visit him. I think we visited him 3 or 4 times. We had some terrific visits. And then while he was in the halfway house, he's been working at Ken Sanders Bookstore in Salt Lake City, and we were able to go there quite a few times, bring lunch, sit down, talk to him, and in one occasion actually take him out to lunch. But there are a lot of restrictions. I mean, I know one right off the bat. You're not allowed to drink alcohol. There's a lot of restrictions.
Yeah. And he can only go where they say he can go. But I think that the halfway house situation has certainly been an improvement, because, to go from 2 years, in prison to the outside, where there are a lot of people that are really interested in you and your story, it can be difficult. So I think that this has been a sort of a nice sort of introduction into regular life, being able to be in a bookstore and, deal with the public and things like that.
We're speaking with Beth and George Gage. They are directors of the documentary Bitter 70, which tells the story of Tim DeChristopher, a climate activist who was convicted to 2 years in federal prison for bidding nearly $2 million on 22,000 acres of land at an oil and gas auction in Utah. Had no intention to pay for the land or drill on it. He merely wanted to make a statement, and he stopped the auction. This is some of the gorgeous land in Utah at the Red Rock areas. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about citizen action? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Call on KALW San Francisco to join in today's conversation. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And, of course, let us know if you're a first-time caller. We love to hear new voices on the show. If you'd prefer to rather write than call, the email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org, feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by focusing on the aging population. 10,000 people turn 65 every day in the U.S. 9 million older Americans cannot make ends meet. Social Security provides about 90% of income to more than one-third of seniors. So what is in store for this growing demographic? If you are in this demographic, how are you faring? And what is the government's role in all of this, especially when we're talking about Social Security and Medicare? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the documentary Bitter 70, which tells the story of climate activist Tim DeChristopher, who was convicted to 2 years in federal prison on March 3rd, 2011. He bid $2 million on 22,000 acres of land at an oil and gas auction in Utah. The feds went after him because he, quote, made false statements during the bidding process. He will be out of jail on April 21st, 1 day before Earth Day. And we're speaking about Bitter 70 and Tim's story with Beth and George Gage. They are the film's directors. This film will be shown Thursday, April 4th at 7:30 at the University of San Francisco Human Rights Film Festival. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. It'll also be shown on Earth Day at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Redwood City at noon. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about this story? I mean, what happens when citizens take on government power? Tim is urging activists to take the long view and be ready to go to jail to defend their principles. He says, quote, "We don't need to figure out how to keep me out of jail. We need to figure out how to get more people in jail." So what are your thoughts about civil disobedience and going to prison for what you believe in? What do you think about what it will take to create political force for major change in this country? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I wanted to ask you both, since you have been in touch with Tim, I'm really curious to find out, you know, when he gets out of jail, what he will say about just how this whole experience has changed him. But did he tell you anything about the prison system? Because I always wonder when people like Tim go to prison, just how it changes their entire view of prisons.
Well, you know, Rose, I think that he's weathered this last, you know, close to 2 years quite well. I think the experience in the SHU, the isolation unit, was terrible for him, but it lasted 3 weeks, and he felt that there are people that are having to endure so much longer periods of isolation because nobody knows about them. You know, maybe their family knows about them, but that's it, and nobody, you know, but really has anything to say. But you know, one of the things that he said to us the very first time that we got to meet with him in prison was that he had met 25 or 30 people in prison since he got there that really did belong behind bars, and most of them were guards. And so, you know, that, I mean, he said, you know, he was in minimum security. So, you know, the people that he was interacting with were not probably hardened criminals. They were, you know, drug arrests or white-collar criminals or things like that. So the people that he interacted with in prison, he had nothing bad to say about. He felt that the guards were very often people who could not get a job anywhere else and found jobs in our prison system, and they were what made it really miserable to be there. But, you know, beyond that, I think he weathered the situation quite well. He really was prepared and determined to be able to sit through this and study and read and think, and I think that that's what he's done.
Why did he spend 3 weeks in isolation?
Well, he wrote an email that was intercepted by or sent to a congressman who didn't really like the language in the email. And the email basically was talking about a company that had been a big supporter of his legal defense fund. And he said that, I understand from a member of that company that they're considering very strongly outsourcing a lot of their manufacturing overseas to Indonesia, China, et cetera. And as you know, that's against my principles. Maybe we should threaten to give them their contribution back. I think the word threaten probably is the word that set off the first alarm. But actually, and again, this is something we tried to find out. We were not able to find out exactly who the congressman was and what his motivation was to actually contact the prison and recommend that Tim be put in isolation.
Wow. Well, let's go to our callers and see what they have to say about this. Let's hear from Marie Louise in Palo Alto.
Thank you so much. And I am so grateful to these filmmakers. It's fantastic. And then also to Tim and for what he's done. And I feel like, wow, if John Muir was here, he would be so happy to see this happening. And, you know, maybe Hetchy could have been saved with people who act like Tim does. And so I just think he needs a medal from the environment and from lots of us. So that's my only statement.
Thank you. I just wanted to add that the day that Tim gets out, April 21st, is John Muir's birthday.
Oh, really? Wow. So. And a day before Earth Day.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you so much for calling, Marie Louise. Let's go next to Jacqueline in San Francisco. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hello, good morning. This is absolutely wonderful, listening to you guys and for putting this on the radio. I can't say anything better than the lady from Palo Alto. I absolutely agree with her. And the other thing, I think that he should be featured prominently all over San Francisco and have him interviewed and brought here, because that is incredible. And anybody who has never lived outside the state of California, and I'm specifically speaking about in the South where we recently moved back from, it is that kind of scary mentality that pervades there, and you'd really have to appreciate what's going on in the world if you live in a place that is that scary stupid. And that is, I think, representative of our government. And for the guy who can't even write an email to his congressman, I mean, they're so dumb to begin with. And that he reacted that way is absolutely ludicrous. But I want to thank you so very much for putting this on the air. And bravo to the guy who did this. It's wonderful, because he exposed them. And I hope everybody realizes what is happening with the Keystone. Mm. And Obama's going to be in San Francisco, everybody. Please let him know. This is no different. And bravo to Tim and your station. Bravo. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
President Obama will be in San Francisco on Wednesday at a $35,000 a plate fundraiser, and there's going to be massive protests and actions. People are speaking out about Keystone, and I'm so glad, actually, Jacqueline, that you brought this up, because I don't know if you both have seen this, Beth and George, but there's some video on YouTube showing tar sands oil flowing through the streets of an Arkansas neighborhood following an ExxonMobil pipeline rupture on Friday. I mean, it's unbelievable to watch.
I hadn't seen it. I'm writing it down right now.
Yeah, we'll put a link on the website right after the show. But the guy who takes the video says the smell is unbelievable. This is incredible. This is oil. People living in homes had to be evacuated. It's amazing to watch. And, you know, when I was watching your film, I was thinking about Keystone. I was thinking about the horrific disaster in New Orleans, mm-hmm. in the Gulf Coast, the 2-year anniversary of the BP disasters coming up in a couple of weeks. And then also here in California, in Richmond, California, we had a horrible refinery in Richmond. Chevron has a refinery here. And they were recently only fined $1 million in penalties for safety violations. This happened last summer. I mean, people got sick. You know, people are dealing with this on a regular basis. So you've got these companies that are barely fined. I mean, this is pennies for Chevron.
Yeah.
And you have this guy, Tim DeChristopher, who's sentenced to 2 years in federal prison for bidding on oil and gas.
It really does show you where our attention, where our government's attention is. And I think it's very, very obvious that, and in fact, the judge said it, that Tim's sentence was to deter other people from doing the same thing.
Right.
I mean, you know, our country was founded on civil disobedience, and it wasn't peaceful civil disobedience.
No.
And now, you know, rather than actually listen to Tim, rather than actually say, you know, maybe he has a point. Okay, he shouldn't pretend to be a bitter if he isn't, but we'll give him some community service time. And maybe we should actually look at the way that these things are being done, because, you know, the government even admitted that they were not following their own rules in this auction. And as you're saying about all of these oil spills and the mining disasters and one thing after another, no one ever goes to jail. And I don't think that there's even enforcement on the fines. I mean, I was watching something just recently about mountaintop removal, and I think that, you know, one of the companies that you know, that was the cause of so many deaths just a few years ago has something like 150,000 violations against
yeah.
it. I mean, it's crazy.
And I brought up before about the Shoshone in northern Nevada, and what happened finally is after the United Nations completely backed the Shoshone point of view, the Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco ruled in favor of the Shoshone and told Barrick Mining to stop mining on the Sacred Mountain. And what they're doing is just paying the fines, they're probably not very much, and just keep mining and just keep paying the fines.
Yeah, and I just have to mention, I mean, Chevron made massive profits last year.
Yeah.
Exxon and Chevron, $71 billion in profit last year. And Chevron was only fined $1 million for this refinery fire in Richmond. It barely got media attention.
And you mentioned before about BP, we're coming upon the two-year anniversary. And you also mentioned before about these 3 years of postponements of the trial, or two and a half, whatever it was.
Right.
One of them was right after the BP oil spill. And there's no way that we as the government wanted to have people sitting in that jury box being reminded of what BP did and make a ruling on an oil and gas possible violation or a violation in the government's opinion. So that was definitely, in my opinion, one of the reasons one of the postponements happened.
And we've got an email from Anthony who says the bankers who crashed the world's economy have gotten away. Tim DeChristopher got 2 years for saving beautiful lands from exploitation. Where is the justice?
Right.
Well,
where is the justice?
That's right.
Yeah, where is the justice? I mean, this kind of exposes it, definitely. You can't really expose it any more than this. We're talking today with Beth and George Gage, directors of the documentary Bitter 70, which tells the story of climate activist Tim DeChristopher. He was convicted to 2 years in federal prison for, quote, making false statements during the bidding process. He bid $2 million on 22,000 acres of land, much of it pristine, at an oil and gas auction in Utah. He'll be out of jail on April 21st, just one day before Earth Day on John Muir's birthday, actually. And the film will be shown Thursday, April 4th at 7:30 at the University of San Francisco Human Rights Film Festival. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. What does this tell you about how the system works? And what is it when you're talking about citizens standing up to corporate power and the U.S. government? What does it reveal to you? And what is the best way to go about making a statement or trying to stop land from being auctioned off for oil exploration and drilling? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Henia Balalia. She's a member of Peaceful Uprising. This is a nonprofit collective committed to combating the climate crisis and building a just and healthy world. And Henia joins us from Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, Henia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, it was amazing to watch so many people get involved with Tim and, you know, helping him along the way and showing up to protest and spreading the word about this. Can you just talk about what your personal experience was like when you heard about Tim's story?
Sure. I actually heard about Tim's story through Tim. We met at the film festival where the Gages met Tim in January of 2009, the Wild and Scenic Film Fest. And when I first heard about his story from him. I was very drawn to his rhetoric, first and foremost, about the fact that the climate movement was not winning and that we had to be very honest about that, and that what we were looking for was not just reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, but a very radical shift in paradigm from the way the world operates now. And that's a lot of what Peace Uprising took on. And then as far as relating to his personal story, I mean, like many other people, I was very inspired because here was a man who decided that protesting as usual wasn't working, and then having folks who were just standing outside of the BLM auction with signs wasn't enough. And he went in with no plan, just the courage of his own convictions and that kind of feeling that if we're talking about, you know, the collapse of our civilization, the end of a species as we are when it comes to climate change and when it comes to environmental degradation, then we should be acting accordingly. And so in a moment, he saw an opportunity, seized it, and went with it. And from that moment forward, never looked back and never apologized for it, really, you know, went all the way to a jury trial and was willing to risk 2 years in prison for it.
You know, it was also great to see so many young people get involved and start the group Peaceful Uprising. Henia, how has this really shaped your views of direct action and what it means to really take on corporations and the U.S. government?
Well, two things. First off, Peaceful Uprising is actually a very intergenerational organization, and so our youngest members are in their 20s, but one of our oldest members is about 74, and so that's actually one of the beauties of Peaceful Uprising is that intergenerational wisdom that is shared between those of us who are kind of starting and have that young idealism with working with those who have been through a lot of different movements. And as far as, you know, nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience, I mean, we need it. We realize that working, you know, within the institutions and within the pathways that we're given hasn't been working, you know, from signing petitions to going to public hearings and expressing our dissent to rallying and marching in the streets. You know, we've realized that if we need to take it, we need to continue getting bolder and continue to escalate, because the system that we're up against is very well funded and very well structured. And when we're looking at the kind of corporate power that's so apparent in this country, we know that the fossil fuel industry is running everything, is running the show, is running our politics. And so when we're looking at creating change, then we have to ask ourselves, if we're really looking at to saving ourselves and creating a just and healthy world, what is that going to take? And obviously, what myself and a lot of other folks within Peaceful Uprising and within the larger climate justice movement realize that it's going to take putting our bodies on the line.
And that's Henia Bilali, a member of Peaceful Uprising, a nonprofit collective in Salt Lake City committed to building a just and healthy world. We're also joined today by Beth and George Gage. They are directors of the documentary Bitter 70, which tells the story of climate activist Tim DeChristopher. And we've got a number of callers on the line, just about 7 minutes left. So let's go through a few and then we'll get comments. Let's hear from Glenn in Oakland. Hi, Glenn.
Oh, hey, good morning. Yeah, what of the Democratic Party in all of this? I mean, it seems like Obama could have commuted this young man's sentence. It seems like a severe sentence for, you know, I mean, it's a lot of time in jail for, you know, compared to some of the other crimes that you've reported on this morning. And I don't know. I think it's a bitter pill to swallow, but we need to stop voting Democratic if we're going to change anything, because there is real no difference between the Democratic Party's position on all of this and the Republican Party's position on all of this.
Well, Bill Clinton recently said the federal government should, quote, embrace the Keystone XL pipeline. So we'll get a comment on the Democrats and the environment in just a couple minutes. But first, let's hear from Kevin in Berkeley. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. Really wonderful. Thank you all so much for being there and the wonderful work you're doing.
Thank you.
What I'd like to say just really briefly is that that so much of the premise that I worked many years, I worked with Greenpeace back in overseas, and there's other groups involved with direct action. And of all the different tactics that I've seen, work on an ongoing, long-lasting basis, direct action has been the only one that has actually stopped the wheels of destruction from grinding. And that's the only thing that I think will stop them ongoingly. It's sets of laws in this country, and that people need to realize that, like Democrats, Republicans, you know, none of that really matters. There's laws for all, 99.99% of us are supposed to abide by, but the rest of the people with the money and decisions.
Oh, I think we dropped you, but we got the gist of your comment, Kevin. Thank you so much. And actually, Tim said the exact same thing in the film, is that direct action is really the only solution. And we'll get a comment in just a few minutes, but we'll first go to Kit in Oakland. Hi, Kit.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for having this show. I want to say, in part for direct action, maybe one thing we can do is on Earth Day, boycott the oil companies by refusing to buy gas. On that day or on that week, support the Sierra Club and the Berkeley Ecology Center. Take a look at what they're doing there. Also, there was a great program on ethanol today, and I think we all should, you know, take a look at what we can do personally by, you know, switching over to solar. Take a look at how we can work to use ethanol instead of regular gas, and send those emails and letters. Support the nonprofits that are working really hard in the climate action field.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Kit. So on that point, and also Kevin's on direct action, what are your thoughts on that, Beth?
Well, you know, I agree with Tim and with Henya and the caller who that said that direct action seems to be the only method that really gets the government's attention. Unfortunately, what is perhaps peaceful on our side is not necessarily peaceful on their side. And, you know, just as putting Tim in prison for this, I think we have to be willing to go to prison for these things. You know, the people are willing to do whatever it takes. The people are willing not to buy gas on a particular day or to march or to write letters, but that's not changing the power structure, and that's not changing the government. And so we have to really, really get their attention. And apparently, I think it takes extraordinary measures and perhaps really large numbers of people to get first the media's attention and then the government's attention, and who will finally perhaps think that they could listen to the people rather than the corporations that they like to call people.
Well, I want to play one last clip from Bitter 70, because Tim addresses this very question. He also addresses Glenn's point about the Democratic Party. And this is Tim DeChristopher speaking at the Power Shift Conference in Washington in 2011.
The way the environmental movement has been for the past 30 years is like a football game. And there's some players on the field that are fighting it out, but most of the people in the stadium are up in the stands. Most of them just paid their money at the door, and now they're just yelling and screaming, and it's not working. Our team is getting slaughtered. The refs have been paid off, and the other side is playing with dirty tricks. And so it's no longer acceptable for us to stay in the stands. It's time to rush the field. And it's time to stop the game.
And that is Tim DeChristopher speaking at Power Shift 2011 in D.C. in the film Bitter 70. What about Glenn's comment that President Obama could have commuted his sentence? Is that true, George? Do you know?
I think it is true.
Yeah?
I think he could have, yeah.
Hmm. He also could have influenced the Department of Justice never to indict him.
Right.
It's the Obama administration that indicted him, that found him guilty, and that sent him to prison.
Did President Obama say anything about Tim DeChristopher? Was he ever asked about this case? Do you know?
Not that we know of, no.
Wow. And also, what about this question about the Dems? Because Bill Clinton recently said the federal government should embrace Keystone. You had Arkansas Senator Mark Pryor, where oil is seeping into neighborhoods. He was one of 17 Democrats that joined all of the Republican senators in voting for approval of the Keystone XL pipeline.
Well, I go back to what someone said a couple of minutes ago. There's no difference between the, there is a difference between the two parties, but there's not enough. And the Democrats are chicken shits.
Henia, what are your thoughts about that? Working through the system or working outside of it through direct action?
I mean, I think it's important for some people to work within the system. I'm not one of those people, just because there is no difference today between a Democrat and a Republican in my mind. There are very, very slight differences in terms of political agendas. I mean, Jim Matheson, who's a Democrat in the state of Utah, is a perfect example, who poses as a Democrat and then was one of the most fervent supporters of things like Keystone XL Pipeline. And I think what's important to remember is, one, we as an organization never pushed for Obama to pardon Tim, and that was part of what Tim was always speaking to, is that, you know, if Obama's going to use any kind of power to do any kind of his power to do anything, then he should be taking a stand and actually passing legislation and doing things about the environment rather than using all of his energy to pardon me. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is that it's going to take a lot more than people just voting and hoping that they've voted for somebody and a Democrat is now holding office, and so now all of our problems are solved. The problem is that we're not holding these Democrats accountable. We're not holding them responsible. We put them in office and then kind of let them run with whatever they're running with. And so I think having the people power and the uprisings that are from outside of the system, are folks that are just saying, like, why work within this broken system? We don't live in a democracy today, and we have to start being honest about that. I think and actually scare our Democrats and scare our representatives and make them feel like the people who they're supposed to be representing are actually upset with them and are going to hold them to that. So that's how I feel about – that's one of the reasons that we choose to work mostly outside of the system rather than inside the system. But again, to create change, you obviously need you definitely people coming at it from all different angles and all different sides.
And that is Henia Balalia. She's a member of Peaceful Uprising, a collective in Salt Lake City committed to building a just and healthy world. Beth and George Gage are directors of Bitter 70, which tells the story of Tim DeChristopher. It'll be shown Thursday, April 4th at 7:30 at the University of San Francisco Human Rights Film Festival and at noon at the Unitarian Church in Redwood City on April 21st. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How are seniors faring in today's economy? On the next Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by focusing on the aging population. Roughly 10,000 people turn 65 every day in the U.S., and 9 million older Americans can't pay their bills. Social Security provides at least 90% of income to more than one-third of all seniors. So what's in store for this growing demographic, and what's the government's role? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.